Welcome everyone to episode 33 of the Greater European Talks. Today we're talking with EU Russia Civil Society Forum, and more particularly Anna Savorkian, the executive director of the forum, about one of their newest reports that's come out quite recently on the state of civil society. Now, this is one of their flagship reports, recapping some of the state of civil society across the EU and Russia. And today I'll be talking with Anna a little bit about the effects of COVID-19 on civil society, as well as some of its effects in the EU-Russia Civil Society Forum's countries. Now, we're very happy to work with the CSF on their Europe Lab project this year. So this is a unique chance to really get to talk to some of the people on the inside and to be able to hear a little bit more about what they're doing and what the state of society for them really is. Anna, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me, Philip. My pleasure being here.
Oh, of course. So I want to start this maybe with, before the report starts, how do you really even start trying to measure the impact of some of these huge pandemics? COVID-19 obviously hit almost every aspect of our society, economically, politically, socially. So where did you really start with the report in looking at how COVID-19 affected civil society?
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. The methodology is always problematic with these really big shifts, where with the pandemic, we did not even know whether we were, you know, at the beginning, in the midst of it, and where we're now. We still don't know. I'll start saying that we've been working on these reports for many years now, for 5 years, and have been usually covering countries in the EU and Russia. And we did not have COVID in our plan when in 2019 there was a discussion in the expert community, okay, which countries do we work on next year? Where do we have the researchers? So there was a plan to have a chapter on France, Austria, Russia, of course, and you will see these three published and available in English, but soon they will be available on Russia and in Russian as well. But then it was just obvious that we will be missing something very important if we just stay with the country approach, or we try to compare situations, because COVID was just such a game changer for all of us and for civil societies as well. So the question, where do you start? We felt there's no other way to start than start interviewing people. And we went through a number of in-depth interviews, talking to professionals, experts, civil society actors in various countries in the EU, in Russia, about how does it feel to be working? What does it mean for the whole sector? What does it mean for societies? And these were absolutely insightful conversations that I guess also explained trends that we've seen. Explain it to ourselves to a certain degree, because you don't know if it's happening just to you when you start researching. You have your doubts, you have your hypothesis, but of course you need to prove that that's really a trend, that's really universal, that's valid for the region where you are. And these conversations were really as I said, insightful, and this is how we've tried to construct our own reality, to speak of what it means for the civil society to be hit by the pandemic. And I should say that what we've done, of course, it was the first wave of COVID, as we now know. So we were speaking, having those interviews last summer, the summer of 2020. And what we've seen was a few obvious things. Civil society actors, they do tend to like jump on important things that nobody else addresses. So the citizens are having their say through just, you know, being where they need it the most. So we've seen that humanitarian response was definitely a big part of what the civil society actors were doing. And really, in various aspects of that humanitarian response were needed, because, well, poor people had their own problems. Migrants have their own situations, and sometimes they were somewhere in the midst of their route, somewhere else, not their own country. Sometimes it was obviously somewhere in the camp. You can imagine what it is to be in a lockdown when you are in a refugee camp. So NGOs or just active citizens, just groups were pretty much reacting to these situations. Sometimes they were the only ones. Well, sometimes they were the fastest first responders. That's what we found. The states stepped in some cases on many situations, but it took them longer. So that's an important role of civil society, the crisis response. And we've seen it in many countries. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it in Russia. We've seen it in our interviews, obviously. Another big trend that we've identified was that it just was not one pandemic, if we may. A researcher from Ireland, Mary Murphy, spoke about the shadow pandemic of domestic violence, for instance. People were locked at home, and then, of course, all the problems that were there between couples or families, they just got exacerbated by the lockdowns, and the crisis lines really lit up. That's also something we've seen everywhere. No matter how rich or poor a country is, domestic violence, the race and domestic violence was definitely there. So she called it a shadow pandemic, and then we realized that it's a term that actually describes many other things that we faced during the pandemic. It was not just the domestic violence. There were a number of so-called shadow pandemics at the same time as we were trying to figure out public health situation and COVID. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that term is one of our big important additions, to analysis of the civil society response to the pandemic, to the healthcare crisis, public health crisis, but along that you have many shadow pandemics, and it looks like the things that were there, problems that were there, but more undercover, less visible, more unseen. Mm-hmm. They were all just really exacerbated by the pandemic and came out really strongly. So we've called it shadow pandemics. And one of the big shadow pandemics is about rights and freedoms, is about democracies or non-democracies. Still changing the balance between rights and freedoms in the society while being faced with, this critical situation, ultimate healthcare crisis, but still, big question, what do you do about basic rights and freedoms? So that's another huge shadow pandemic. Mm-hmm. I'll stop here, probably.
That's fantastic. Thank you for giving me the outline for it. One of the things you note in the report as well is obviously the adaptation, and that's not just for focusing on the public health crisis, but also the fact that funding was rapidly cut. So kind of in your opinion, the combination of funding cuts and the combination of kind of having to stop activity on a lot of traditional CSO focuses, has that had a medium to long-term impact, do you think, or will it have an impact on the future of civil societies? Or do you find that there's a strong possibility they can bounce back quicker and bounce back stronger?
Well, absolutely. As I said, COVID, this whole situation in its complexity has been a game changer for the civil society. What we've heard from our respondents, for instance, they were saying, yeah, well, humanitarian response, wonderful. Everybody saw, and I mean, even more conservative authoritarian governments praised NGOs or groups of people that were, of course, you know, helping out and being part of that humanitarian response that was recognized. But it means that it's going to be much more difficult to actually go back to advocacy and start doing other things, just to really get their voice back and speak out on other topics. With funding, again, it's understandable. This is the crisis we need to work on. Some of the sectors, of course, also saw a significant growth in terms of donations and funding available, because this is where you need the response, this is where you need the human resources, this is where you need everybody. But yes, it means that then the resources are very heavily skewed towards that one issue. And after a couple of months when we were all adapting to the situation, yes, humanitarian crisis, we need to be thinking about this and that and changing our ways. Well, this is when exactly the voices appeared that started paying our attention to, slightly more subtle aspects of pandemics. For instance, how do you do the court monitoring? How about access to justice during these times? How about the healthcare situation in prisons? And, well, many, many areas where you previously saw funding or, you know, the need to support them, that funding went, of course, to the most critical sphere, which was the direct response to COVID. But the thing is, of course, you need a very direct, you know, focused on public health and humanitarian needs response to COVID. But it doesn't mean that all other things that civil society was talking about suddenly disappeared. And mm-hmm. of course, we've seen that disproportionality. How much would that change civil society altogether? I think that the change is there already. And we know that many groups, of course, they lost quite some resources. Well, the economic situation that also was not necessarily good for public funding of civil society, like a broader spectrum of what civil society does, not just the healthcare. The impact's been negative. I wouldn't say that we've seen yet a lot with private funds, again, being rerouted back into, again, critically important things in advocacy, in supporting the educational activities, you know, the human rights and freedoms work, environmental work, so on and further. So definitely COVID also changed the financial, well, streams for very many groups. COVID will put some of these groups out of business. COVID for sure opened up new possibilities. COVID helped to rethink the ways we work. And I think we're still rethinking how we work, how we travel. The important thing is that we shouldn't miss this chance and just go back to the pre-COVID ways when we can say that we've handled the COVID, yeah. We've passed that stage, but we're not there yet.
Exactly.
So yes, it's painful. It's painful for many associations now in terms of figuring out their financial sustainability.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit about kind of the way we've changed of work. And of course, a section is based on the new generation of activists. And you mentioned how it may even produce something as valuable as digitalization and a new kind of active wave of citizens. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Do you think that maybe sort of digitalization has also opened up new avenues for civil society owing to the COVID pandemic locking us all inside?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think without the pandemic, we wouldn't have been able to start working from home on the scale that we've been doing that and see that it actually works. I'm speaking from Berlin, sitting here in Berlin and Germany, where Digitalisierung, digitalization has been a big debate. During the pandemic, we really had a lot of associations, public voices appearing in this discussion. So it's an important, very important part of public debate that started happening. But we're not faking anything here. I'm definitely in Berlin and digitalization is happening. And I think it's a big issue that we started realizing, I think, on a different level. It's not just, well, how to have efficient services, how to have services digitalized, efficiently organized for all of us. It's, of course, about the access to our data, It's about how we share information, what happens to the information online, what does this mean that we're going to be storing data online, what does it mean in terms of threats, what do we need to learn to be more secure. Especially, it's sensitive, of course, for some organizations in the civil society working with human rights issues and violations and so on and so forth. But actually, I mean, not only, it's relevant for all of us. So in terms of just having this on the agenda, working digitally, and what does it mean? I think it's been, again, also a big shift for many of us. And there is such thing as governmental surveillance, part of digitalization, or the big question about how the data is being used. So somehow, while we were confined to our homes in many cities, in many places, and our computers, our devices were that window into the world, then of course we realized that we do need, so you have the road safety. I mean, you do need also digital safety here. It's much better pronounced. I think it's much better actualized for many at the moment. Still, a big question how these processes should be happening in terms of, switching, going to digital, to virtual space, rather to physical space. So,
I think it's been interesting seeing how sort of many people almost relinquish having to go back to the office. You know, they view it better for them, and you see sort of activity to try and always keep some of the positive aspects of it. And also, as you mentioned, data. Civil society has always been there at the forefront of trying to protect the data of people. And during this pandemic, that's only become more exacerbated. You mentioned how obviously this report's only been written for the first half of last year. Now, maybe you haven't already started work on the next report, or maybe you haven't already talked to some of those in the sort of second and third waves. Anything you notice has changed since you wrote the report that you maybe wish you could have added in?
That's a great one as well. We are now rethinking the whole methodology for the reports and playing with an idea of, maybe doing it around the topic of civic space. Everybody speaks about shrinking civic space, but we don't really understand what we mean by it. So we're now working on a report in a new format, thinking this through. But of course, we keep monitoring and talking to people and see how the pandemic response is changing, and we're just trying to see whether the trends that we've noted for the first wave are staying valid or what's being added. So I didn't mention, I think, another important trend that, and we see more of it now, so fresh patterns of inequality, so to speak. The more vulnerable became even more vulnerable during the pandemic, or, you know, the combination of those vulnerabilities is hitting them very hard, and we absolutely need to be addressing it. What we mentioned at the end of our chapter about COVID was, many praised NGOs for being heroic, working 15 hours per day for months to really help us get through. Many have seen that they're amazing initiatives that were there before, and what we call the new generation of activists. Really, these would be people that, like Chechen refugees in Poland that started sewing masks and giving it out to community. Definitely helped in terms of the community feeling that they all are coming together and somebody cares. And things like that we've seen in many places, in Russia, really lots of initiatives, to take care of, pets, for instance, of people who were sick and had to go to the hospital and kind of provide for people that didn't really know, provide them with that type of care. So, or again, people mobilizing, standing up for their rights. Again, a Polish example where they also lived through a presidential, electoral campaign during the first wave of COVID. And people were not really ready to wait and put this whole thing on hold. You know, they had to be a part of a conversation about the future of the country. I mentioned digitalization here in Germany. So, and all of these things were praised or noticed, but what did not happen during the pandemic and what we also see now, that it did not change the balance, again, of civil society having the say on matters of public interest. As, again, in many parts of Europe, we now see the dynamics. COVID-wise is good. We see some, you know, relaxation of the wearing masks mandate and other things. And it feels like, oh, well, okay, maybe we figured it out. Still, it's incredible how little we have of civil society discussing how the recovery should really look like. We immediately go into big businesses, you know, what do we do for the airlines? what do we do on the state level? What about the big businesses? And that was also something we've seen in the interviews. Industry, the business world, which much more organized in terms of lobbying for their interests, speaking to the governments, speaking to the international organizations, and civil society wasn't. Civil society was handling things on the ground, trying to help, you know, people and, well, address many issues, but definitely wasn't lobbying for itself. And that's something that I would still hope. It's not too late. I mean, I would still hope it's not too late to get more voices of people who really had like hands-on experience of dealing with this pandemic, personal level, but no actively helping, standing up to have their voices for seeing the plans for the recovery. So that's something that I would want to have another round of interviews on and speak with people so much more on how they see we should be all changing now and how the civil society and its vision can be better reflected in policies. So that would be my take on that. The recovery, which, you know, we're charting it out at the moment. And I don't think that we're speaking to the actors that were part of handling the pandemic, and we should.
To follow up on that, essentially, you do end with kind of an honest world in which proper attention is paid to civil society is the hope. But why do you think attention isn't being paid? Why do you think the civil society is being ostracized from the recovery, from the reconstruction plans, when, of course, it's played such a huge role in the pandemic and will likely continue to play a big role after it as well?
Well, systemically, it hasn't been part of, you know, of these big discussions, and I would want to see it there. There's, again, sometimes we've seen recognition in, you know, documents by European Union bodies or structures, but you just need to be inviting the leaders of these organizations or the field workers of these organizations when you speak about the recovery. I mean, we read about it in the news, but we should be talking about it. So that's what I mean. The civil society is definitely not at that stage where it is an actor that is being taken seriously and has a say on the level of policy. It's not sitting at the table, and this is where it should be to my mind. Mm-hmm. So a long way to go here. Of course, I don't expect it's one of the, I don't expect it's going to be given. The civil society will be invited. It just means that, again, advocacy that by the civil society actors that was unfortunately, well, again, it changed during the pandemics and it was not possible to, of course, do it offline. So we need this type of advocacy and the civil society needs to be coming together also as businesses do, for instance, and making their voice better heard. Well, not just to be part of a conversation. we started with civil society actors, with those initiatives, with little groups, or sometimes just, you know, people. They were the respondents, or they are still the respondents. And of course, to have a better response, you need to factor that type of information, those voices in. Mm-hmm. They do have the important perspective on what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't suppose by any chance, obviously, the EU is going around right now. Von der Leyen has a tour around Europe, giving the approval for all the huge sums of recovery money. Have you heard any chance of civil society being involved in that? Or is this not something that that you've maybe looked at? Do you know if they're being involved in the huge EU recovery efforts? You mentioned how the EESC sort of looks at civil society as a key player, but I wonder if this translates into the reality.
Well, again, not we have not done a structured research on that.
Of course, yeah.
But it's very hard to do any structured research if you're not part of, and you know, the kind of NGO input is not part of how things are being done and decided upon. I'm thinking about advocacy efforts by many organizations for having like a bigger share in the new European Union's budget for a so-called rights and values instrument, and for funding, well, democracy, educational development in the European Union countries, as well as outside of the European Union. It's been a huge fight. It's been very difficult. And of course, the NGOs, and there were lots of them from all over Europe, didn't get what they wanted. They didn't get close to what they thought was, you know, a minimally needed amount now to really work with education, political education, all sorts of development programs that are needed also within the EU and outside of the EU. So, yes, unfortunately, I think even without having a deep insight where those pockets that can be used for the civil society to play a role in the pandemic, yes, I think that's been not enough on that front in terms of inclusion of, again, our visions at the level of planning, not just at the level of execution. That's an uphill battle, I know. That's a long process. I really hope that we can still use the recovery moment to actually change other things for the better. I mean, change other things, use this crisis to get better.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And although you already kind of ended that sense of optimism, but I'm gonna hit again with that optimistic note and just ask quickly. So obviously we've talked about almost the depressing side of COVID-19 and CSOs. I mean, there's been the positives as well in terms of us coming together. But in your opinion, what is something you are hopeful for in relation to COVID-19 and the future of civil society organizations?
Thank you, Philip. Yes, I'm a professional optimist, having worked for civil society organizations for pretty much all of my life. I'm very privileged to have been in that sector. And of course, I am hopeful. We've got a lot to do. We've seen that the old problems, even bigger and tougher because of COVID. So we would need to redouble our energy working on these things. We've seen opportunities. We've seen that we can probably rethink travel. We've seen that, the connection between COVID and the climate crisis became, I hope, much clearer for many. And my biggest hope lies exactly in the new generation and all of these people that felt they need to be doing something during that time. And I hope to see them on the battlefield.
I love the rallying cry there at the end. Thank you very much, Anna, for joining us today.
Being a little belligerent today, but it's Friday.
Exactly, it's Friday. And as you say, we need to have our voice heard out there. And if that's what they're going to listen to, then that's one way to do it. All I'd say is thank you again for joining us, Anna. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation.
Thank you, Philip. I enjoyed it very much. And I didn't say a word about France or Austria or many things about Russia and other countries, but all of our reports are online, and we were very happy to engage in conversations, debates, get your questions and simply your feedback on what we've been exploring as the civil society research at the Russia Civil Society Forum. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. We will, of course, put the link to the report in the description of this podcast, so do check it down below, wherever you get your podcast from. All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for listening, all of our listeners. Please do follow us, and please do follow the EU-Russia Civil Society Forum. We're working together on the EuroPlan project as well, so you'll doubtless see us and their logo spread out over July as well. And all that's left to remain is wishing you, the listeners, a safe and happy days ahead. And thank you very much, and have a good day.